Well, good morning, everybody. It's been a little while since I've been up here, and faces have changed a little bit since last time, I believe. For those of you that don't know, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. I often say that I was imported to deepen the gene pool just a little bit around here in the Mennonite circles. I grew up in a family of four, my mom, my dad, myself, and a younger brother. And one of the things that we enjoyed doing as a family was to go snow skiing. Probably don't think of Memphis, Tennessee as being the home of a snow skiing, but when I was 8 or 9 years old, we visited Pennsylvania, of all places, and went to visit some friends there, and they had a great big snowfall, so I rode a snowmobile for the first time in my life. We went one day to Elk Mountain and skied with our Yankee friends. You see, I grew up in a family where we were still just a little bit sensitive about having lost the War of Northern Aggression. I think you Yankees call it the Civil War. A few years later, when I was in junior high school, my family went out to Colorado snow skiing, and we had so much fun that it became an annual event. Because my dad was one of those guys that when he did something that was really fun, especially if it had something to do with sports or recreation, he was all in. So it became something that we did every year. My dad would plan the dates, he would select accommodations, what mountains we were going to ski, and he would invite anybody that wanted to join us to go along. And we would usually end up with like 3 to 5 families that would drive from Memphis to Colorado. Now that drives about 1,000 miles. And back in the days of 55-mile-an-hour speed limit countrywide, it took us about 20 hours to do that. And we would drive straight through. We'd stop for gas, we'd stop for food, and that was it. And typically, our route would take us up through Arkansas, Missouri, across the state of Kansas, and then finally into Colorado. Now, if you've ever driven across Kansas, you probably can relate to this. Kansas is probably the longest state in the United States. I think it's wider than Alaska. It's flat, it's uninhabited, and it's exactly the same view the entire time. It lasts forever and ever and ever. In fact, when you finally get to Colorado, you're still not out of Kansas because the next 2 hours still looks like Kansas. It's 2 more hours before you can finally see the Rocky Mountains. So anyway, one year we were driving across Kansas. It's the middle of the night, and it looked a lot like that picture right there, except it was dark. No street lights, and we got caught in a snowstorm. And we're driving straight through, and all of a sudden, big snowstorm. And the wind's blowing, it's foggy, we can barely see. We can just see the taillights in front of us. It's us, our little convoy of 3 or 4 families, a little bit of truck traffic, and we're probably going like 15, 20 miles an hour. I mean, we couldn't get off. First of all, we're in Kansas, and there's not an exit ramp if there's nothing to go see, so there's very few exit ramps. And even if we could have got an exit ramp, we couldn't see it. But unfortunately for him, but fortunately for us, it was an 18-wheeler right about Hayes, Kansas, who tried to get off the exit ramp. He got off, and he got stuck. But to our good fortune, what he did was he took his flares and he lined the exit ramp on both sides so that anybody that came behind him could see where the road was. So we got off the highway and we were stuck. I can remember we went into this restaurant, 24-hour restaurant. It was called Sambo's. Sambo's, I think it was probably a chain. Anyway, it was a pancake restaurant. It's about 2 a.m., and when you go into a place like that, a restaurant at night, you can't just sit there. You need to order something. It's only right. And a place that smells like pancakes, well, you're going to be hungry. So we had some pancakes about 2 or 3 in the morning. About 8 or 9, we had some more pancakes. Finally, 8 hours after we first stopped there, we finally got out of this Sambo's and headed on towards Colorado. Anyway, today we're going to begin our four-part sermon series on Moses. I'd like to ask you, what do we know about Moses? When you think of Moses, what do you think about? He received the Ten Commandments. He wrote the first 5 books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. We know that he was the leader of the Israelites. He led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt and into the promised land of Canaan. In Numbers chapter 12, it tells us that Moses was the most humble man on the face of the planet. And then again in Deuteronomy, we learn that Moses lived to be 120 years old. And it even tells us that when he was 120 years old, his eyes were not weak, so he still had 20/20 vision, give or take, and that his strength did not fail him. So he's 120 years old, and he lived and saw like a young man. Now, biblical scholars often break down those 120 years of Moses' life into three different epics. The first 40 years, when he was in Egypt. The second 40 years, when he was in Midian in the desert, in the wilderness. And then finally, the last 40 years, when he's leading the Israelites out of Egypt, across the desert, wandering, and eventually to the promised land. Our scripture today talks some about some of that. Interestingly, in Exodus 2, where we read from, if you start in verse number 1, Moses is born, okay? By the time we get to verse 23, where Tim stopped reading, Moses is 75 or 80 years old. So we don't know a whole lot about Moses' first two periods there, but we can do a little bit of inference, kind of read between the lines to discern some facts and if we take some other parts of Scripture. Like we said earlier, he was born into the tribe of Levi to a slave family in Egypt. He was abandoned by his mother. Now, it was an effort to preserve his life because, if you remember, Pharaoh had decreed that all the male Hebrew babies must be killed at birth. So his mother floated him in a basket where he was found by an Egyptian princess in the Nile River. And then she went on to hire his mother back to raise him. So his mother raises him. By the time he's a toddler or a little after, mother gives him back to the princess. And then he's raised as a prince of Egypt. So Moses, who is he? On the one hand, he's a Hebrew by blood, but he's an Egyptian by culture. He's a slave by birth, but he's royalty by adoption. So I think we can understand and infer from that he likely had a bit of an identity crisis. Who am I? Where do I belong? And who are my people? So in the middle of chapter 2, where Tim read earlier, in the midst of kind of a curious moment, he goes out to see the Hebrews. What is it that the Hebrews do? Who are they? How do they live? And while he's out there, he sees this Egyptian slave master who's overworking and then abusing one of the Hebrew slaves. And at seeing this, Moses has this visceral reaction. He suddenly sees himself as a Hebrew. He identifies with this person, and he metes out vigilante justice. This Egyptian abuser, he murders him, and then he hides him in the sand. Says he goes back the next day, sees the Hebrews there again, and now, this time, he kind of fancies himself a peacemaker. He sees two Hebrews fighting, and he says, hey, I'm going to intervene. I'm going to go in, and I'm going to broker the peace here. And the one Hebrew who he has decided is at fault there, looks at him and says, what are you going to do, kill me too? All of a sudden, Moses realizes he's known. He's been seen. The murder was not a secret. And he runs. And he runs for good reason. Because it turns out Pharaoh has found out about the murder as well. And he's put a price on his head. And there's a warrant out for his arrest and even for his life. So where does he go? He runs into the desert of Midian, the wilderness. And there, he sees some shepherds. He sees some shepherd girls who are trying to water their flock. And he sees some shepherd boys who are mistreating the shepherd girls. So again, he intervenes. He gets in the middle of it. He chases off the bad boys and he helps the nice girls. And the girls are very grateful, but they leave him sitting by the well, and they head home. So they get home, and their father says, how'd you get here so quickly? And they said, oh, we had some help. This Egyptian helped us out. He ran off the bad shepherd boys and he took care of us. And Dad says, well, where is he? Why didn't you bring him home? Go get him. He said, well, you know, we should take care of this guy. After all, we're in the desert. Not a whole lot of boyfriend material out here in the desert. Maybe this is a candidate. So Moses comes back. The father is very, very appreciative for Moses' effort, to the extent that he gives one of his daughters to be a bride. So Moses gets married to one of the daughters, and together they conceive a son. It says that Moses names the boy Gershom, which means, I have become a foreigner in a foreign land. So it seems that Moses is still dealing with this identity crisis. He doesn't belong here. He doesn't belong with the Hebrews. He doesn't belong with the Egyptians. Where does he belong? So now Moses is 41, 42 years old. Everything that he knew has been left behind. And it's his fault. It's his own doing that got him in this situation. He has a new family, has a new son, has a new occupation. He's a shepherd. And then nothing. Just a whole lot of shepherding. Wandering around the desert. Waiting. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. The wilderness. The desert. Solitude. Silence. Obscurity. Waiting. Now when we look at this, if we put on our analytical minds as biblical analysts, the two of us, you and I, we can look at these 40 years in the wilderness and we know the story. We can see that the 40 years in the desert and that obscurity, we can see that made sense for Moses. We know what's going to happen. We know what God's going to do with him in the future. It makes perfect sense. But take yourself out of the analyst mode and put yourself in Moses' position. What was Moses thinking? What must he have thought in that moment? What must he have felt like? I'm a foreigner in a foreign land. I've got a son and a wife and some in-laws, but no blood family. Nobody who raised me. Nobody who knows me. Why am I here? You see, I don't think he was just in a physical wilderness and desert. I think he's also in an emotional, social, spiritual desert as well. On the one hand, he can say, I was royalty. I was in line for the throne. I had everything. What have I done? I threw it all away in a fit of rage. And I deserve everything that I got. In fact, maybe I don't even deserve what little I have. Now, next week, Bishop Keith is going to come and tell us the next phase in Moses' life, how he comes out of the desert. But today, I would like to talk about this emotional, spiritual desert, about living in the spiritual wilderness. Tim alluded to this. A few months ago, Tim invited me to preach. And it wasn't like a specific Sunday or a specific topic or anything. It was just like a general invitation. Hey, let me know when you're available to preach. And I remember telling him, well, you know, my schedule's kind of complicated. Sometimes the timing is such that it's really hard for me to commit far ahead to knowing that I'm going to have a Sunday off. But I'll let you know. And then over time, over the last few months, couple different times he said, hey, I'd love to hear you preach. Again, no specifics. Every now and then, maybe a kind word, you know, he'd heard from other people, but never any pressure. He even sent me outline for this sermon series, for these four sermons. And he didn't send me an invitation. He didn't have any other communication. I just got included on an email for the outline. And I just assumed that he knew that if I wanted to respond, I could if I was interested. So last Sunday, 7 days ago, I came up to Tim and I said, "Hey, I'd love to have a few minutes with you if you have time." And I was thinking like in this past week sometime, and because I knew he was preaching and everything, I didn't want to get in his way. So anyway, after the service, he came and found me, and that's when I told him that I've been in the desert. I've been in a spiritual wilderness. For a number of months, I was in a place where I just didn't feel like I was hearing God's voice. And I said, honestly, that's the bigger reason that I hadn't really made good on your invitation to preach, is because I wasn't sure I had anything to say. But then I was able to tell him that just in the past few days, God had kind of broken the silence with me. I began to see him at work in my life. I began to feel his presence in a new and fresh way. It was very emotional just telling him about it. I could see that God was blessing me and loving me and forgiving me and caring for me. And I said, I think I found my way out of the desert. And really, I didn't. God had led me out of the desert. And now, as funny as it sounded, the one sermon in the Moses series that I really would not have wanted to preach, this one, was now the most relevant of all the four. And then he looked at me, he said, "You want to preach next Sunday?" And I was like, that doesn't seem right. That's just a week, you know. And he goes, "Hey, if it's too soon, if it's too personal, you don't have to." I said, "Give me 24 hours. And here I am. 24 hours, God kind of said, yeah. So here's some of the things that I feel like I'm learning, or trying to learn at least, about the desert, about the spiritual desert. Number one, deserts are normal. It's a normal thing. Scripture's full of examples of God's people being in the spiritual desert. Abraham. Abraham was promised at age 75 that he'd be the father of many nations. And he spent the next 25 years wondering if maybe he didn't hear God right. There was this guy that was pampered, overly favored by his dad, Joseph, who arrogantly shared his dreams with his brothers. And for his troubles, they sold him into slavery. He finally finds his way to a fairly good situation with an affirming master, and then he's falsely accused and imprisoned. Joseph had a series of deserts and wildernesses. Job. I don't even have to say anything but Job. And we all understand. He lost it all. And then in the midst of his grief, his friends lose it on him. Then his wife loses it on him. So Job had a desert of loss. He had a desert of tragedy. Had a desert of desertion. Jesus had this ongoing relationship with deserts and wilderness. Early in his ministry, he goes out into the desert fasting and praying. And who does he meet there? Satan himself. Throughout his years of ministry, the desert and the wilderness was a place of retreat and solitude for Jesus. He would go to find solitude from the masses, the people who just wanted more and more and more. He would go to find solitude away from his own followers, who were at times shallow, petty, selfish, and totally misunderstood him, his mission, and even their mission. He retreated to the wilderness to spend time with his father, to hone his focus, to find strength in his soul, and to refresh himself with the only one who could possibly understand. So number one, deserts are normal. We should expect them. Number two, Deserts are different. Almost every desert experience that you or I or anyone else experiences is unique. How does one find themselves in the desert? Well, Moses very clearly put himself there because of his rage and his murderous acts. Abraham allowed himself to doubt what he had heard, and he found himself in a wilderness of wondering. The desert was kind of thrust upon Joseph by his brothers. Another period of wilderness foisted on him by a wicked woman, and then that desert prolonged by forgetful colleagues and associates. So how do we end up in the desert? Well, there's lots of ways. Like Jesus, we can go there to seek solitude and freedom from distraction. Like Moses, we might get there from our own mistakes. It might just be an ailment or an illness. It might be depression or mental fatigue, family troubles, relational issues, or it might be for a reason that you can't possibly even understand or figure out why. It just seems like you're driving down a foggy road on a dark highway and you can't find an exit ramp. But I think this is true. I think that deserts are normal. I think that deserts are different and unique. And third and final, deserts are ultimately temporary. There's a way out. Just like that dark, snowy highway, and we're looking for the off-ramp, there's a way out. For all the ways he bumbled, Abraham had a son, Isaac, and he is the father of many nations. For all of the misdeeds and troubles that were committed against Joseph, he became the second highest ruler in the whole land of Egypt. He rescued the brothers who sold him into slavery, and he spent time at the feet of his father and brother who he thought he'd never see again. And Jesus, who endured the greatest single period of desert, of desertion, of abandonment that ever existed, while in that moment on the cross when God turned his back on him and he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He followed that up with the greatest exit from the desert, from the place of death, despair, and desecration that's ever been. On the third day, on Easter Sunday, he came roaring back out of hell into life and ultimately was seated at the right hand of the Father in heaven above. So yes, deserts are only temporary. So when deserts come, we can use them, we can survive them, we can grow in them, we can emerge from them victorious and refreshed and possibly even resurrected to do new things.